anybody in the country.
That's unnerving.
And they wanted to see us get a good, fair shake. So you just have to kind of keep your fingers crossed and try to follow what's going on.
Try to follow what is going on. After more than 100 years under the flag of the United States, Eskimos, Indians, and Aleuts are pressing for settlement of their claims to Alaska. Various regional Native organizations, combined with the statewide Alaska Federation of Natives, are spearheading the efforts towards settlement. But after 1958, the new state, which had literally no money and was completely dependent upon the federal government, began looking for productive lands in the state of Alaska. After all, they had a right to select 103 million acres of land. It was after they began selecting the lands around the hunting areas of the natives, around the villages of the natives, that the natives finally got a little shook up about their rights.
Throughout Alaska, a new breed of native leader began to emerge. Iwanati, an Athapascan Indian. John Borbridge, president of the Tlingit Haida Council. Flory Lekanoff, an Aleut. Former state senator Evan Hobson, an Eskimo from Barrow. Byron Mallott, a Tlingit Indian. Willie Hensley, an Eskimo from Kotzebue.
The plan at that time was to just get as many of the representatives from all of the villages together and make a claim, and which we did do back in the summer of 1966. What we did was we just took a map and we just made a sort of a circle around all of the area that all of these villages in this region use, you know. We hunt and fish and camp and, you know, we use it. And then we sent that into the Bureau of Land Management. And that, they accepted that. And that kept anybody from getting the land. And the idea was to try to get the Congress, that is Washington, D.C., the Senate and the House of Representatives, to pass some kind of a law that would say how much of Alaska the Native people should own, you know.
In the fall of 1966, representatives from many villages and regional Native organizations met in Anchorage. It was the first of many times that Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts came together seeking a common goal, settlement of the long-standing land claims. The Alaska Federation of Natives was born. Today, the AFN represents Alaska's Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts in the highest councils of government, in the Congress, at the White House, and at the Capitol in Juneau.
So what we're trying to do, by forming the Alaska Federation of Natives, is to try to get the federal government to grant land to people in the villages, that is, the village as a group, you know, and so that they can do whatever they want with it, you know, rather than have the government, you know, dispose of it or give it to somebody else. But in the past, the government has always wanted to pay the Indians, you know, money for the land. This has been going on for years. Our main interest was the land, you know, because we figured that if we lost the land, you know, we'd be in tough shape. Because I had seen, you know, what it's like for the Indians down in the States and some of the Indians in Southeast Alaska who don't have any land, you know, just, and they have to live on other people's property or they have, you know, to rent land from somebody else. And to me, anybody who lives in Alaska, especially the Native people who've been here, they ought to have the land. Now, you know, here in Nervik, there's no pressure, you know. You can't really feel that anybody's going to get it, but life changes, you know. I remember when I was here back in the early 50s, going to school one winter, and at that time, all the little kids, they spoke Eskimo, you know. And now they don't. Now, that's not been very many years. And up on the Arctic Slope, you know, just a few years ago, there was nobody was drilling for oil. Now there's lots of oil activity, lots of roads up there. Some of you might have been up on the slope and you see all those oil wells sitting up there, you know. This might happen a mile from here, you know, I can't tell. But one thing is sure, that once there's that kind of development, you know, lots of business, that affects how you use the land. For instance, down at, you know, Sisoli, people from Noatak come down and use that ground. People from Kasubi come down and use that ground. But anybody can, for instance, go to Fairbanks and go to the Bureau of Land Management office, you know, look at some maps. He could look at Sisolik and he could see that, you know, nobody's filed on that, you know, because if they did, somebody at the office there would mark out the squares, you know, that would show that somebody was living there and was using it. But the way we use land, you know, we don't go to no BLM office. You know, we go out there and we use it. So anybody can go in and claim that, and then you have a tough time proving that you really was using it and that was the land you wanted, see? So what I want to tell the people in the villages is that we gotta think about the future and be aware of what it means to own property, you know, a piece of property. It's unfortunate, but that's the way life is now.
Over the years, and with great effort, the AFN has forged its proposal for settlement. Its details are a series of compromises. Al Ketzler is president of the Panama Chiefs and an official of the AFN. He outlines the AFN proposal for settlement of the land claims.
The AFN bill calls for a payment of $500 million. This is for lands that have been taken and are in third-party hands, and of course the land that we will be giving up. We're asking for 40 million acres. This is asking for four townships per village and a formula of if there is more than 184 people in a village, the acreage will be additional on a 500 acre per head formula. The areas that are covered by reservations will have the option of either keeping the reservations or going to the four township formula. We're asking a 2% overriding royalty on all leasable minerals, which of course is mainly the gas and oil in the state.
Alaska Secretary of State Robert Ward reviews the state government's position.
In terms of the basic settlement, the governor feels that those villages that are involved in the settlement should have from one to two townships of land. But those villages that are not in national forest land in Alaska, that those villages should be entitled up to two townships of land, and two townships, of course, is 46,000 acres of land, 23,040 acres per township. Those villages in national forest land that are located on national forest land should be entitled to receive up to one township of land, or 23,000 acres. Along with this, the $500 million cash settlement that the Department of Interior has recommended earlier, that has been approved by the Bureau of Budget, Governor Miller feels it's an equitable settlement and a generous one in terms of monetary settlement to the extinguishment of those claims.
Arthur Goldberg, a former Supreme Court Justice and United Nations Ambassador, and Ramsey Clark, a U.S. Attorney General under President Johnson, head a group of attorneys representing the AFN. Interior Secretary Walter J. Hickel has continued his predecessor's ban on federal land transfers in Alaska, the so-called land freeze. The state of Alaska has unsuccessfully tried to overturn this freeze in court.
You know, before the state can be allowed to take the land that it selects, they're going to have to prove by
Senator Ferguson
the court process
that's
that
absurd.
There's really no native claim to it, see? So every selection they make, we can contest that. And of course, no state doesn't want to get involved in the long court fight. The business people, you know, don't want to get involved in the court fight. The oil companies don't want to have problems over rights of way, you know, and leases and stuff like that.
may require the state to participate in the settlement. Secretary of State Ward.
It seems to be the thought of some of the members of Congress, at any rate, that the state does have some obligation and the state should participate in the settlement of Native land claims in Alaska. The state administration, Governor Miller, and the state administration does not feel that that's the case. Actually, when you consider the fact that the 375 million acres, that is Alaska, was purchased from Russia and is the property, and most of it still is, even though statehood was 12 years away, or nearly 12 years away, that is the property and was the property of the federal government, and as such belongs to all the people of the United States. And the state does not have any legal basis or any right to settle any portion of the land claims against the land that belongs to all the people of the United States. And so therefore, the state cannot, no state has ever done it before, and we just can't see any reason at all why the people of Alaska should be settling claims for land that's owned by all the people of the United States, and it's the public domain of the United States.
Included in the AFN's land claim settlement proposal is a provision which would guarantee to Alaska Natives for 100 years rights to subsistence hunting, fishing, and berry picking. Secretary of State Ward.
This is basically the state's position, the subsistence land for subsistence hunting and fishing. We also feel in this regard that the present laws of Alaska provide for subsistence hunting and fishing on land in the state of Alaska, and also that fish and game resources are the property and responsibility of the state government for the benefit of all Alaskans, and therefore all fish and game resources should be managed the same way for all Alaskans and equitably for all Alaskans.
Whatever form the claim settlement finally takes, it is likely to include a substantial amount of money. The AFN would like both the money and the land administered by village or regional corporations. Woody Hensley.
They want to have a statewide corporation, a big corporation, of all the native people, all 55,000. We don't think that's a good idea, because we want it as close to the people as possible, you know, because each area is different. It's different up here than it is in Southeast.
Well, do tell me possibly some of the uses that the funds would be used for the land claim settlement.
Yeah, this is the same, you know, question that we're asked when we're in Washington, D.C., testifying on the land. You know, the congressman wanted to know, well, you know, what are you going to do with $500 million, you know, if we allow that much? And so we have to answer. And I think that the answers are pretty obvious. We could put some money into some good programs, you know, like using modern techniques, you know, television, you know, for training not only children but adults too. Just all kinds of things that can be done. And what AFN is trying to do is to try to get as much of the control over the funds, you know, into the hands of the native people. We need flexibility, you know. If we need to invest money here to get a big return, we should be able to. I think there'll be a lot of pressure, you know, by the state to have us build facilities that the government should build, because we could spend $200 million just like that building water and sewer, you know, for the villages. In other words, you know, I don't think that we need to, you know, utilize or use up all the money that we get in the settlement, you know, doing things that ought to be done, you know, by the state government or the federal government or together. But I'm not saying that, you know, we wouldn't be able to pay our share of it. But I think we're going to have to, you know, work with the state to some degree on some of these programs.
And there's another question that often raised in our villages was that when we get our land settlement, that we'll become a first-class citizen. And does the public health and the education, do we have to pay for all the
moved out by, you know, by business activity and, you know, people moving in from the lower states. When the congressmen think about land, you know, for a village, they're not thinking in terms of the amount of land we need, you know, for subsistence, for hunting and fishing, you know, that the villages now, you know, do. And they think simply in terms of the village and some room to grow, you know. But that's, you know, that's certainly not what we're thinking about when we think of what the villages want in terms of the land.
Yeah, Willie, that if we can get a home site like what our friend has up at Guyana, then the villages can have a good portion of the land.
That's true. All the people who use the land, that is, have, you know, a camping site where they have tent frame, they have other places where they use quite a bit for fishing, they should try to get some kind of title to it, you know, whether it's a home site or whether it's a train manufacturing site or whether it's a native allotment. They should start staking it out, you know, because this is about the best time to do it. Even though there's land freeze on, you know, you can have your marks, your markers, you know, all staked out, so as soon as the freeze is over, that you will have started the paperwork, you know, to get that land.
Right. How about the people that have tree fishing sites or trapping sites?
Well, right now, the native allotment is still on the books, you know, it's law. You know, and some years ago they changed it so you can get 40-acre sections, you know, in different locations. And this is just, you know, just perfect for the way that we live in the villages. And you may have different locations you use, so you can get those home native allotments. But, you know, some of the bills, they want to do away with that law, you know.
From his view as an Anchorage member of the state legislature, Tom thinks he's a changing pattern of life as a result of the claim settlement.
In the long run, I believe the native way of living will change substantially. I think the subsistence economy will go. I believe that when the natives receive the land and the money, their various organizations will logically be forced to conclude that in order to perpetuate the sound economy, it will be necessary to bunch their people up into larger villages and communities. I think that they will conclude that any amount of money or any amount of land will not perpetually sustain a subsistence type economy. I think that it will be necessary for them to have freezer plant operations, mining operations, various types of businesses. The people will insist upon certain services which no amount of money can provide in the way of educational type buildings and the plant for communities of 50 to 200 people. I think that the talk of such a tremendous amount of land in the long run really will not be necessary because the way of life will change. I believe the non-native cannot force a change on the native, but I think the natives will force a change upon themselves.
I think some of the village people know that, you know, what might happen in the future, you know, if we can get some amount of land, you know, for the villages. And I think some of them don't, too, because they can't see the changes that will be coming, you know, to Alaska in terms of land use, maybe 50 or 20 years from now. For instance, the state has not made its land selections of 104 million acres, you know, because of the land freeze. And there is nothing that could prevent them, or would have prevented them, from selecting land anywhere around the villages that you guys come from. Once they make their selection, you know, then it'd be very, very tough for even individuals, you know, to get
going to bear on that in their camp sites and hunting sites. And the way, well, what brought all this to my attention was when I used to fly back and forth across the United States. And you look down and you see all that land down there divided up in little squares. And that's privately held land. And if people can see that, people from the villages can see that, they'll see what I'm talking about. Because, you know, whoever owned that square can say, you know, no hunting, you know, or do not trespass on this property. And that's something that we're not used to up here. You know, we use the land, hunt, fish, travel, and this is going to happen to Alaska, and it's happening now.
Question was, a lot of characters still around, huh? Well, let's talk about some of these while he puts the other thing on. Royalty. Robert Ward is now Commissioner of Transportation, who was Lieutenant Governor under Miller. And some of you remember Governor Miller? Well, Keith just didn't have too much, you know. Now, Ward was tough, and he took a lot of the hard stuff. Keith Miller, I don't think he knew what was going on. He was a very nice fellow. He could sing Your Cheatin' Heart real good at the baritone. But Ward was, there was a big issue about whether or not the state should have any responsibility for participating in the payment or in any way in the settlement. You know, having, he felt that this was a federal problem. And of course, this 2% royalty, what we call an overriding royalty, was a very big issue. And the Miller administration never did support it. It amounted to almost half the financial settlement. You know, this is what we got prepaid last year. You remember in the last legislative session? Paid all at once instead of waiting on the 2% over a period of time. Yeah. Well, we felt that we'd be better off having the money in hand be worth more back, you know, when we got it than it is now, and we earned interest on it during the period of high interest. So it was very advantageous from just a pure dollar standpoint. And with the Ward, the state never did come around. Keith Miller never did come around. In fact, I suppose Keith Miller was probably the only governor who had $900 million to spend, right, from the Prudhoe Bay oil sale, and lost. And when Egan came back in, Egan recognized that we weren't going to get anywhere in Congress were the state not a little bit flexible on this subject. So he supported it. And we got it in. Of course, we wanted it in perpetuity because that is forever, because we were going to lose our land forever, right? But we just simply didn't have the horsepower to do it. So we only got it for a limited amount of dollars. Now, the other question, Dan Lisburn, who doesn't live anymore, isn't alive anymore, he was from Point Hope, and he was one of the few people, the older guy that was with us in that group, who was working for his people at that time. And he was curious as to what was going to happen with the, when he talked about being a first-class citizen, you know. Well, I wonder what that is, but nevertheless, I presume he meant that if we were first-class citizens, that means we'd have to pay like everybody else, right? It's taxes. Well, tried to reassure him that government was the government's responsibility, right? That is the idea of a public education. And in those days, that was not that long ago, we had almost not the slightest effect, you know, on the delivery of any kind of services, whether they were state or federal, in the late 60s, even up into the late 60s. It was ruled by bureaucrats, right? I mean, we had virtually no effect on the way the Bureau of Indian Affairs was operated. And it was, when you think about it, it was rather horrendous because we were virtually powerless. I mean, we had almost no influence on any institutions that came into contact with us. And so we recognized even then that we shouldn't have been required, and we didn't want to be required to have to perform services of government. We knew that our money would not simply last. It would not last at all. And so this is something that's still a current issue, as our position was and is that when we got the settlement, it was a kind of like our treaty with the government. We did not agree to give up our identity and our relationship with the federal government, you see. And so consequently, the Public Health Service and the Bureau of Indian Affairs and all other Indian-related programs are still programs that we never agreed that we would concede to give up. And but that's still an issue that's in effect still before the government, because the Office of Management and Budget, you know, is still questioning from a legal standpoint whether they're still responsible for various of our sundry items like they used to have in the treaties, you know, blacksmiths and blankets and, you know, rations and that sort of thing, from which the whole panoply of services to Indians has emerged. And on the land, the state was unwilling to give more than a couple of townships. You know, on the one hand, he was saying it's the federal government's responsibility, but then he was trying to tell the government how to do it, right? Secretary Ward. I mean, if it was just between we and the feds, why should he care how much land, you know, we secured from the public domain? But nevertheless, the guys in the village were concerned about the plots of land that we had used. You see, there was two different ways of looking at land. We were in one direction, we were trying to make use of the public land law that was already available, right? When I mentioned the T&M sites, the trade manufacturing sites, was a matter of public law, which we as American citizens could have access to. In fact, this was one of the ways in which we were somewhat mistreated, because as I was trying to point out, you could have walked into BLM here and just checked out a map anywhere around Kotzebue, Kiana, any village, and if there was not any specific record, you know, of some kind of transaction that was recorded on that public domain, anybody could have walked in and took a 160-acre homestead, you know, right there on the outskirts of town. In that day and age, it would have been legitimate, right? Unless there was somebody who had the nerve or the money to challenge it. And that had been going on in my area. So I was trying to get people to not only take, you know, go and file allotments, because the allotments, it was, had been on the books since 1906, but they had nobody to help anybody, you know? Like I said, the one guy covering all of Western and Northern Alaska, and nobody knew that this thing was even on the books. At least that would have been one way of protecting the lands that you had you used substantially, you know, for one reason or another. But we made a last push, a final push, just, you know, prior to the passage of the Act. It was the only way that we were able to secure individual allotments, you know, for people, for the lands that they used. And trade manufacturing sites, allotments, or home sites, you know, 5-acre tracts, we could have secured also through the normal process. But nobody had any idea about these means of getting getting land under the available laws. Yeah. And, of course, Tom Fink was going to bunch us up all in towns of 5 or 10,000 each. And, of course, this is what they did in Denmark, I mean in Greenland, right? They took them out of these little towns and they decided to improve their way of life. Well, they were going to do the same thing with Project Chariot. They were talking about it, you know, up there at Cape Thompson, when they were going to try to blow away the an harbor there with some atomic weapon. I mean, you know, people have no concept of, well, let's put it this way, things haven't changed very much, you know, even until recent times. That is, people felt that they had a, of course, Tom was saying that, well, it's not going to be us telling them how to live, they will want to, right? And this has always been a concern. This way of life, I don't know, when you see those, when you see the, in all of these, that hasn't been that long ago, there was a substantial amount of, what, you know, this mutual support system, right? Those boys carrying all that water, right? Everybody's carrying all these fish, you know? And when I talk about the disintegration, you know, of identity and of relationships, you know, to me, that type of thing has helped maintain that, right? It's a mutual dependence. And of course, nowadays, what is there to do in a village, right? I mean, you got a bathroom, all you got to do is flush it, right? You don't have to lug it down somewhere. Right? You got water, you don't have to go lug it back from somewhere. You know, you got oil, you don't have to chop, right? So what are people doing now? What kind of effect is that having on lives, and what is ultimately the effect on them? Anyway, any questions on this thing? That was back about 69, and we frankly didn't have too many people who. We just didn't have time. You know, this is supposed to be sort of an educational product that we could take, you know, wherever and use it. And it's amazing that we managed to pull it off because we had so little to work with and events were happening so quickly. Yeah.
How did you go about getting information to all our communities?
Did you travel to? We had regional meetings, and we couldn't afford to go village to village like we do every year now, just to present financial information for the shareholders. But we'd have delegate meetings, but it was completely inadequate. I mean, the government didn't fund us, you know, like they do in Canada, to negotiate with the government. And we just did the best we could under the circumstances. We didn't even have radio like we do now. And we just used letters and occasional visits and representative type meetings, you know, of our boards. That's the best we could do at the time. That's the way life is now. I guess they took that from some wise saying from some wise man. Yeah. Huh? No, that's fine. I don't know what they have. Okay, this next one. It was done by 60 Minutes. And Mike Wallace came sailing into Kotzebue one time on a crummy day, and he was trying to get to Barrow, couldn't land, and he was going to do a big oil story. Well, he switched when he got here. He found out that there was no big oil story, it was a big land claim story. And,
Poor guy is stuck in Kotzebue. Does that have anything to do with
the
switch?
Well, no, he looked me up. I didn't look him up. So we'll show it to you and see what you think about that.
Billions upon billions of barrels of oil lie under the frozen Arctic in Alaska. And last week, the World Petroleum Company's $1 billion jumped for the right to drill for that oil. That's only the beginning for the state and its people. In fact, the nation as a whole will grow considerably richer from what must be the biggest oil find in North America. But as one Alaskan Eskimo put it to us, you're getting rich on my land. His land, he says, simply because the Eskimos, the Indians, and the Aleuts, the Aleutian Islanders, were there first before the white man. And it remains the native's land, he says, because he never sold it, he never lost it through war, and he never gave it away by treaty. Repeatedly, the United States government has promised to settle the land claims of the Alaskan natives. Well, now, says the Eskimo, the Indian, and the Aleut, now it is time to pay up. A fair settlement to the natives means a big chunk of Alaska's land for their own, a settlement in cash, and a share in the state's development, including that oil bonanza.
This is where the oil boom is on in Alaska, far north of the Arctic Circle on the coast of the Arctic Ocean. The ice floes drift offshore, waiting to freeze tight again as winter begins. In summer, there is endless daylight. Soon, it will be endless night. Here, Atlantic Richfield and British Petroleum struck oil last year. Now, a dozen companies are drilling well after well, some dry, but so many successful that they know they have struck what could be one of the biggest fields in the world. On the flat wasteland, permanent camps are being built to house drillers and roustabouts working 12 hours on, 12 hours off, week after week. No women, no whiskey, no guns are allowed on the North Slope. In winter, at 60 and 70 below, men slow down and machines break down, but the drilling goes on around the clock. The oil in this ground is worth billions of dollars, and the Alaska natives say they are entitled to a share of a 2% royalty. This is the natives' most controversial demand because huge amounts of money are at stake and because it's tangled in Alaskan and Washington politics. It is the federal government which promised the natives a settlement, but the state which now has the right to those royalties. and the state shows little interest in giving the natives a share of that oil money. No matter how bleak this land may seem, no matter how rich it is beneath its surface, this is the ancestral land of the Eskimo. As the white man moves in, the Alaskan native fears that he will be forced out.
The village of Kotzebue is on Alaska's barren west coast, 30 miles above the Arctic Circle. Almost 2,000 people live here, 1,800 of them Eskimos. The Eskimo was here centuries before the white man came.
There are 55,000 natives in Alaska. Slightly more than half are Eskimos, some in trading centers like Kotzebue. Most of them, though, in tiny villages, scattered along the western and northern coast. These are the people who now ask America to recognize their claim to this land. The natives ask because they and their forebears have always lived here, fished and hunted here, depending upon the land for subsistence. Even now in Kotzebue, fish and seal meat hang to dry and then to be smoked. Some of it to feed the sled dogs, most of it for the family. Alma and Laura Davis live here with their three daughters and a son. Dinner is a stew of reindeer meat bought at the local market and dried caribou shot by Elmer Davis and kept in a cold storage pit in frozen ground under the house. Children and parents all live in this one small room. It's one of the reasons Eskimo disease rates are high. Tuberculosis occurs 20 times as often among Eskimos as among other Americans. Elmer Davis works by the hour a few days a week for the local electric company. Unlike many native families, the Davises do not get any welfare help. But they have no savings for the future, and Elmer Davis is now 62.
Laura Davis, who owns this house that you're living in?
He owned it.
Your husband owns it?
Yes.
How do you know that he owns it? Do you have a piece of paper that says that he owns it?
No.
Elmer?
No.
You own this house?
Yeah.
Well, what about the land that this house is on? Who owns the land that this house is on?
Both of us.
Do you have a piece of paper that says that you own it?
No.
Don't you need a title? Don't you need a...
I never asked for.
With none of the white man's paperwork to prove his ownership, an Eskimo's claim to his land is in jeopardy. In Kotzebue, whites have filed for title to all of the choice sites. So the Alaskan natives are asking for cash. $500 million now for land already taken from. That's in addition to future oil royalties. But more than that, they want ownership of 40 million acres, 10% of Alaska's land.
The Japanese investment in the United States, as you know, is the largest that they have abroad. It's 28% of their total global investment. In this country, there is enthusiasm for the Japanese system. The idea that everyone participates in consensus. consensus of the man on top. The decision is something that apparently appeals to many American workers. This is reflected in a recent story about the CETO company in Texas, where it was said that the workers were very happy.
Money is the way that it should be felt.
The Alaskan natives are pushing their land claims all across the state. The Aleuts in the Aleutian Islands, the Eskimos along the coastlines, and the Indians in their small villages in the interior.
This is the Indian village of Tanacross, about 450 miles north of Anchorage. Indians have lived here for centuries, long before the white man arrived here. They feel this land is theirs by birthright.
The people of Tanacross have good reason to fear that the white man wants their land. Their chief is 69-year-old Andrew Isaac.
States like to get it all if they can. And we want ourselves to have enough land for our native people that we can use it, because we know how to use this land long before this white folks come to Alaska anyway.
Chief Isaac says Tanacross and the neighboring villages use 6 million acres of these mountains and rivers and lakes. It is country that remembers the gold rush that saw wildlife decimated to feed the miners. Now the highway to Fairbanks makes this prime land for vacation camping. The state tried to sell wilderness sites here at the New York World's Fair, even though it was land the Indians already had claimed. Chief Isaac had filed papers on behalf of his tribe, which were lost or ignored by the state and federal governments. This is a state campsite, again on land the Indians say is theirs. Indians often arrive at their ancestral hunting and fishing grounds only to find white fishermen and hunters already there. The Indians still depend upon berries picked and canned for winter. To Chief Isaac, it is the land, not the cash, that is important. Title to the land would enable his people to continue to hunt and fish and pick berries and develop the land as the white man does. At the fish camp of Tutatuliak, Philip Guy, a 28-year-old Eskimo poverty worker, spreads the word about the land claims to villagers who never knew they had cause to worry whether they owned this land. They have no television, no radio or newspapers in their own language. Guy tells them they must press their case. For under this bleak land, he says, the oil companies think there is another huge pool of oil, riches to be tapped another day. The native leaders want their people to get a royalty from that oil, a share in Alaskan wealth. Can the natives handle the land and the cash if they get it? Oil money already has given one tribe the chance to prove it can. These rigs pump oil from Cook Inlet near Anchorage. When oil was discovered underwater there, oil companies also bid on drilling rights on shore, and this Tionic Indian village received $12 million, a village of just 250 people. By pooling the cash, they have transformed one of Alaska's poorest villages 5 years ago into a model community. Each Indian got a new house and shares in the tribal corporation. Now they own part of a construction firm and a charter airline. In Anchorage, they have built these modern office buildings, which also house their own headquarters. Indian John Borbridge manages another tribe's affairs. He is the vice president of the Alaska Federation of Natives.
We don't think the land and the rights of the natives are on trial. We think, very frankly, the obligation of the United States to do justice to the Alaska natives is on trial. Our rights are firmly grounded in legality. They're grounded in an ample number of cases. They're grounded in national policy. So that it is not we who are being tried as to whether or not we have substantive rights, but it's the United States government and its willingness to fulfill its obligation.
In Washington, Senate hearings are considering proposals for a settlement with the natives of Alaska. Representing them, former Supreme Court Justice Arthur Goldberg and former Attorney General Ramsey Clark. At the moment, most proposals would give the natives about a quarter of the land they're asking, somewhat less money than they want, and no royalty on Alaska's oil. The administration is determined that a settlement be reached quickly. Alaska's former governor, now Secretary of the Interior, Walter Hickel.
What we're trying to do is once and for all settle this issue. Now, my predecessor, Stu Udall, said, we'll grant no more title until Congress faces up to this issue and once and for all settles this claim. I agree with that. And therefore, we're pushing strenuously in both houses of Congress to once and for all find out who owns this land, what part they should have, give them the title, and let's get on with the show.
Mr. Hensley, what will the Eskimo do? What will the Native people do if their claim is not allowed?
What else can we do? I don't know what we can do. However, I do know what the consequences will be of our losing the land and not becoming a part of the development of this area.
What will that consequence be?
The fact is that we'll continue to be as we are now. You know, we are poor people. We have very poor housing. We have very poor health. And we'll just have some very serious social and economic problems of a particular segment of our society in Alaska.
The native peoples of Alaska are America's smallest and least militant minority. The Eskimos, the Indians, and Aleuts do not demonstrate, they do not picket. They do not threaten civil disobedience if the white man fails to meet what they regard as fair demands. Instead, they simply ask their fellow American, the white man, to be just.
Man's challenge to another man's land was summed up by the late Carl Sandburg in his book, The People, Yes. Sandburg wrote, get off this estate. What for? Because it's mine. Well, where did you get it? From my father. Where did he get it? From his father. And where did he get it? He fought for it. Well, I'll fight you for it.
Easy to talk to, and he's a real pro. You know, and the interesting thing is that, you know, he'll be just sitting there and talk, and he'll go through a whole string of questions. And then they'll take they take different angles. But what he does to do that is that he remembers every question he's asked. Like he'll sit there and take a retake and just rattle off maybe half a dozen or more questions, virtually word for word, you know, that he asked during the interview.
But this was
we had to use everything that we could, you know, to try to make our point, across the country. And so, with the minimum amount of people that we had, as well as the lack of money, to try to bring this
issue to the consciousness of the country.
This type of free publicity was essential, you know, to reach millions of people. And another thing that we did do was we used some do-gooder type organizations that had some money and that had contact. We did a editorial campaign, something similar to what Alaska has tried to do with D2, you know, where they sent a red voucher across the country talking to editorial
groups, editors, and editorial boards to try to bring them Alaska's point of view. And you grind out these editorials that could be used by chains of newspapers urging a legal settlement. Also, the outfits like the Association of American Indian Affairs in New York had contact with very powerful people like in the New York Times, either owners or board members of the New York Times. And they wrote articles as well as editorialized on the subject. So, and we also made appearances before the various church groups, such as the National Council of Churches, and secured resolutions of support from them, as well as specific church groups, some of whom assisted by loaning funds to different groups. And we also worked through the labor unions, securing resolutions of support from them and using their lobbyists as well. So it took a rather phenomenal amount of energy trying to cover all those bases. And at one point we generated our own PR office. One of those fellows in the first films that I was speaking into the mic was Jim Thomas. He was a Clinton from Yakutat, who was sort of in the business of the media, and he sort of headed up that office for us. So it was in that fashion that we tried to generate the support that we need, as well as scouring Capitol Hill with our own people. And the way we sort of that was by using the Land Claims Task Force. And because we didn't have any monies of our own, and and because we had the state stymied because of the freeze, you know, we got Hickel, when he was still governor, to agree to create the task force under what was then called the Rural Affairs Commission. And this was created, I think, in 1967 or 68, somewhere in there. And this actually was a campaign commitment that Hickel made, in effect, when he was going to, when the AFN first met in 66, in October of 66, the headline in the Anchorage Times was Hickel to create Native Department. Right? And that was probably a first for Bob Atwood, because he didn't support Egan, he supported Hickel. And Bob Atwood never had, I don't believe, in the entire existence of that paper from the 40s to the 60s, or whenever it was, ever written a pro-Native editorial or article, to my knowledge, except when he wanted something, right? Like when he was trying to encourage statehood, he wrote some editorial, portions of editorial saying the Natives should go for statehood because we're going to protect your land rights. Of course, that was a disclaimer clause that was in the act. But nevertheless, this creation of this Native department was a campaign ploy, because we were all meeting there for that first statewide meeting we ever had. And so this didn't turn out. Of course, it's a little bit more difficult for the state to do what the federal government can do in terms of, you know, creating a Bureau of Indian Affairs, right, because of the Constitution. So instead of a Native department, they simply came up with a commission, which could be up to 60 members or something, I forget, and it didn't have any specific duties, but they did provide travel and per diem. And so what he did was he created a series of task forces out of this Rural Affairs Commission, which I ended up being chairman of, even in the Republican administration. And I chaired not only the commission, but the task force. But he also created a timber task force and other things. But what we did was we came to a position where the state and the natives were going like this, and, you know, we weren't going in the same direction. And of course, what we needed to do was get together and go see Congress, right? Because we had, through Secretary Udall, had gotten him to do this land freeze, you know, which had absolutely stopped the state dead in its tracks in terms of its land selection program, its ability to lease lands for oil and gas or any other purpose. What it did do is it froze everything, ultimately. That is, homesteads, trade manufacturing sites, airports, anything, right? I mean, let's talk about some leverage, man. And we got into the driver's seat, finally, with that. Somewhat in the driver's seat. It depended on the department, Secretary of Interior, and the federal government. But if that didn't create a hell of an uproar, you know, because that was seen as an infringement on the contract for statehood, which in effect was supposed to give the state 104 million acres, but we maintained that statehood was fallacious, that they could not legitimately grant our land to the state. See? And so naturally, when Hickel was governor, he did everything he could to try to eliminate that freeze, which was his duty as far as he read it, you know, to protect the state. You know, which, you know, we recognize, but we had a problem with that. And so he had Edgar Paul Boyko, who still exists, still practicing law, still flamboyant. You read his wild articles in the All-Alaska Weekly every week or every other week. And Boyko had supported Hickel during the campaign for governor. You know, walked on TV with this little briefcase full of stuff saying, in this briefcase I can take care of the Egan administration. You know, I mean, it was one of those deals, political deals. Anyway, he became the special consultant to Hickel, and then ultimately Attorney General. So this task force, we decided that we'd try to get together with the state on various issues, especially the form of payment and the land and other matters, you know, that we could. Because we felt that if we're fighting with the state, we'd never be able to get the Congress to move. And so we also tried to tie in, you know, not only the state, the AFN, the natives, but the federal government. So we'd have a meeting, every time we met, we'd have representatives from all these bodies there. And of course, by that time, we had the state in a knot. They couldn't move on the land. And so it was to their interest to talk. And what the task force allowed me to do, I mean, what the commission, well, we had about 30 board members in the AFN, and we convinced Hickel to put them all on the task force. And the task force selected me to chair it. And they, in effect, gave me the authority to select, I forget, 7 or 9 people from the group to be on the steering committee, right? And this steering committee was to basically, in effect, to negotiate, to come up with a proposed settlement. And So I looked around and I just picked, you know, Emil Noddy, I think, John Borbridge, Hugh Nichols from Barrow. As it turns out, it turned out that he was not Inupiat, right? He was from Montana somewhere. But he had the spirit, right? And he was dedicated. And I told the people from Barrow, when Eben Hobson and them came to me to complain after I took a little break after the appointments, they said, what did you appoint him for? I said, well, if he's good enough for you guys, he's good enough for me. I said, why don't you go in the corner and you and Walton, Amaroff, another Barrow person, get together and you three select somebody. I assumed that they'd come back and say, well, Evan's the one. But they didn't come back, so I just let Hugh stay on there. And Hugh had the knowledge anyway. Yeah. And I forget, you know, I tried to be, you know, somebody from Barrow, lots of you, Bethel area, the interior, you know. So we tried to spread it around, and what we did was we met for weeks, almost every day. And we couldn't, of course, we didn't have the authority to make decisions. We only had authority to try to work out a proposed land acreage, some administrative forms, some dollar figures, you know, and that sort of thing. And then after we'd work, we'd get the whole group together and go over that. And what we'd do is generally met in Anchorage or Juneau, and we'd meet from morning till night. And then we'd go down to the Montana Club till morning. And the story was that, of course, we'd all be high after working all day and partying all night. The next day, when we'd be sitting there negotiating with the state and the federal government, they'd say, well, how do you all feel about that? We'd be going this way. You know? We'd be so dead asleep, we'd be agreeing. Anyway, we finally came up with a proposed state bill as well as a proposed federal bill after all that frenetic effort. And the key, of course, was trying to get some agreement from Hickel on the amount of land. And that's what we came to an agreement on in an elevator in Juneau. As a matter of fact, I had to go to some other meeting, and I left them in Juneau, and Emil called. Everything was in disarray. I mean, you know, the closer we were always got to coming to some firm commitment on something, you know, everybody wanted to run many different directions. And we used to have a saying that we'd meet a problem head on and then skirt it, you know. It was very difficult to get people to commit because, you know, once you got committed, then it's going to be tough to change. But the only reason that Hickel would go with $40 million was because he thought that we could get half of that from federal lands or like National Forest or the Petroleum Reserve Number 4 or the refuges, that sort of thing. And of course, we never did get the commitment we needed on the 2% rule. But we wanted to try to get as close as we could on other matters, right? And of course, from our standpoint, we had a lot of different issues because we had some, you know, like the reservations that existed. What do we do? You know. Of course, the option was that we did come up with an option for them. You know, they could either stick with their reservation and not participate in the act, or they could take a look at the proposed settlement itself to see if they'd be better off. And that was in there. And we had a very difficult time dealing with the question of the regions. Because in effect, the development of the AFN sort of inhibited the idea of forming those tribal entities that were the general means of solving Indian land matters, right? They formed a tribe based on a linguistic and
language, a certain area of occupancy, and, you know, a tribe, tribal entities. And we had all ended up with our separate associations, you know, Arctic Slope, Nana.
Ultimately, Bering Straits had formed a group just before the Act passed. The AVCP area, the Bethel area, we had the Tanana Chiefs Conference. So in effect, what we ended up with was something akin to a tribal entities,
but it wasn't exclusive. That is, it didn't exclude Eskimos, say, if they lived in Fairbanks, you know, or it didn't exclude Indian villages that might have been down in the Southwest. So, the Congress was very sharp, right? I mean, they created these corporations. And you see, when Tom Fink was saying, well, the native people themselves will change. See, this was the vehicle that, in effect, was going to help that, wasn't it? Because the Congress simply was not about to create another tribal entity that was going to be exclusive to the American mainstream. They did not want to create another government. But as far as Senator Jackson and others were concerned that had been involved in Indian affairs for 25 or 30 years in Congress, in their opinion, the system hadn't worked, had it? Because the Indians were still Indians. And to their apparent view, this tribal system had not elevated the people, the Indian people. Perhaps that's what they saw. Perhaps they did not like the idea of the continuity of these people wanting to live together, you know, as separate societies in America, especially when the federal government was still paying, you know, for their upkeep. And so consequently, if we had tried to go that route, it would have been we would have been against a real wall. In fact, our position was at that time that we did not feel that it was going to be possible to get the act through and get the kind of land that we wanted if we had tried to go this route. And that public, the Federal Field Committee book, that huge one that you see up there, Alaska Natives in the Land, that was commissioned by Jackson to come up, you know, to do sort of help legitimatize this whole, because there was so little knowledge in Congress about what had gone on in the past with respect to Alaska Natives and their way. And it was a blue ribbon group. Joe Fitzgerald was the chairman of it. And it was sort of designed to focus federal spending in ways that would fit with the state after statehood occurred in 59. It was created after the earthquake, I believe. And so they came up with a pretty much of an economically oriented product that was in line with what Jackson and Boone were interested in. And you see, the thrust always has been to go for an economic settlement, because it's easy.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but I think you got a leaky in response.
That was earlier.
Okay.
Thank you. Actually, it's a good conversation piece. No. yeah, you did screw up my thought process. when Clem Tillion mentioned can I help you? When Clem Tillion mentioned the idea of payment, see, that's sort of traditional, right? I mean, nobody wants the Indian to have his own land. And it's much easier to pay. That's why we pushed so hard for land. You know, we knew, you know, what instinctively knew based on history what the thrust was going to be. Yeah.
What did you, with that 2%, if you knew that you weren't going to get 2%, why did you say, okay, we'll take 1%?
In perpetuity?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Well,
you just, you know, to appease them.
Look, my friend, we had to walk over the whole state to get 2%. And we would not have gotten that had we not gotten Egan into office. Or had he not won office, let's put it that way. Because the state was dead set against paying anything. And yet the Congress was insistent that the state participate, to the point where in the act itself they had a provision in there that if the state challenged it, you know, I forget what the, you know, there was going to be some consequences. I think all federal aid to the state would be cut off or something to that effect. So trying to get something in perpetuity is what we wanted, but it was simply not in the cards. Now, yes?
What would have happened if he would have just let that standoff then?
They would have cut off aid to the state. In fact, it's in the act. I'm not sure what section it is. But they didn't want to see, because it was unique, that is a state participating in the settlement of what in effect was a claim against the federal government. You know, it was a unique requirement on a state. And
contradictory to me, because did that guy get an office by saying he was going to create a land claim task
force? He did create the land claim task force, and in fact it did help move along the settlement, you know, because prior to that we simply weren't getting together and we weren't affecting Congress, because the Congress would, you know, they saw this warring group up there, you know, they weren't about to walk into something that was you know, totally in contradiction, and we felt politically that it wasn't advantageous to the Native community either. You know, we wanted to try to get as much agreement as possible, you know, before we went to Congress, and in fact we did not. We had a tough time holding Hickel to this, very tough. After we had gotten him committed to it, he was afraid of the electorate, because you probably don't remember, but the emotions were pretty hard. Don't you remember? You were here then. I mean, cripes, I mean, as far as the state was concerned, we were holding up the pipeline because of the land freeze. We were holding up any sales or leases of lands, and we were holding up the homesteads. And let me tell you, it was no picnic. And emotions were fairly high. Nevertheless, he finally said, finally before the committee, that whatever Congress in its wisdom, you know, would agree to. But you see that we did eventually move up this figure to 60. But it wasn't in the cards. I mean, in reality, the federal government was unwilling to give up. Well, Chairman Aspinall didn't want to give up 1 million acres. And he was a very, very powerful figure. I mean, he ran his committee with a strong hand, you know. And in the final analysis, he came along. But not until we had been able to get these people going with us.
Yeah.
It sounded by the film that a lot of the land, like around Cottonview, had been claimed by non-natives before all this happened.
Mm-hmm.
Were there any conditions where some of that would be, like some of the land claims which were probably immediately surrounding the village would be reverted back in village land? Or
actually, you know, the thing is, we're so doggone nice, you know, we never think about taking somebody's land back that they stole from us. Let me tell you what the way this was done, so you'll understand it, because this is something that, you know, people don't understand. Under the town site law, you know, you could go out to a public domain, and any, you know, all these people here can get together and petition for a town site. Okay? If it's unreserved, you know, vacant and unappropriated land. Okay? And so the federal government comes in and they survey. And in fact, for all practical purposes, Cottonview was public domain land, because for a long time, until the late 50s, when they incorporated and got a survey. And generally the government comes in and they survey, you know, lots and throughout the town. And then they, what they agreed to there was they allowed whoever had a house to not have to bid against anybody for his own lot, right? Like, well, there were already homes on them. So they just paid, they prorated all the costs of the survey, and so maybe you end up paying, say, $25 for your lot. But what they did up there was all that land surrounding Kotzebue that had been subdivided, they sold at an auction. Okay? And of course, in an auction, I mean, most of our people don't have any money. Also, they were out berry picking or hunting or just simply not aware, right? They had never read the legal notice. And so all that land, hundreds of lots, were sold, and only the people who had money or were aware of it bought it. So those were the traders, you know, the government workers, like the doctors and the nurses, you know, or the businessmen. They ended up owning the town. And what happened, of course, at the time was, by the time that I came along in the 60s, you know, there were a lot of young people who were getting married and looking for land, and they didn't have any. They'd have to go squat on their other, you know, on their relatives' land. And then these lots, now you can't buy a lot for $10,000, you know, which they paid $25 for, maybe, or $100. Right? And they didn't have to do that. You know, the people simply were not given the option of a native town site, which was available under the law.
Yeah. After somebody gets land, like, say if I was to get land from that town site and it was surveyed, it would be taxed.
Oh, well, it depends. See, most depends on state law, right? Because in a community, you're either you're a municipality of some type. In most villages, of course, they didn't have the authority or the power to tax. See, back in the, what they did was they created the, what was called the Village Incorporation Act, which Eben Hobson was a part of creating when he was in the legislature. But this kind of complicates matters, because this is the part of the state, right? And of course, most of our communities were organized under the federal government, under the IRA, which was a federally chartered corporation. I mean, this in effect was a tribe, right? I mean, the Indian Reorganization Act was applied to Alaska in 1936. Which was passed by the federal government in 1934, for the resurrection and revitalizing of Indian tribes. Remember the Dawes Act of 1884, when they allotted all the land? Well, the consequence was between 1884 and 1934, you know, in 50 years they lost, 90 million acres of land, right? Because they took the tribal lands and they cut them up into little squares and were going to make a 160-acre farm out of it so that the Indians could be civilized. Well, what's a piece of paper to an Indian tribe, right? I mean, if they were accustomed to living a tribal way. So they lost all that land. Well, IRA was created to rejuvenate the Indians and created a method by which they could form tribal constitutions, have elections, form tribal businesses, and gave the Secretary of Interior power to increase the reserves or try to rebuild the tribe and rebuild the land base. Well, up in Alaska, this was applied, but on a village-by-village basis. So many of them were formally, federally chartered tribal corporations, in effect. So we still have IRAs in existence today, along with the state entity called now second-class cities. And second-class cities, I don't believe even yet tax land or property, real property. See, if you have a status of municipality, like a first-class city or a borough, then the land could be taxed. But if it's land that's under what you call, trust land, like if you secured a native town site, which generally the deed is restricted, right? It is land that really is owned by the federal government for your use, right? And you have to go through a process to be able to sell it, and it cannot be taxed unless it becomes fee land. That is like complete ownership. Yeah?
I've heard of people selling that kind of land and then getting money for it, but they don't really own it.
Yeah, it can be done, but what you have to do is you got to go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and prove your competency. Right? You have to, it's designed to protect, our land was taken for, $100 in Kotzebue. Somebody got drunk from the family and sold it. Wanted more property. Well, this competency thing is you go to the Bureau of Indian Affairs and fill out some forms showing that you know what you're doing. And they give you the authority to sell it.
Yeah. We take great confidence.
Sure. That's a very good idea.
Colonialism, etc. Now, as you notice, I am not accusing the Japanese at all on moral grounds. I am only pointing out that what the Japanese do naturally at home when taken into different social milieu sometimes runs the risk of colliding with the accepted practices and principles of those host societies. And the Japanese, the only thing that has to be blamed to the Japanese in this case is presumably lack of imagination. How in the first place did they assume so naively that all other societies were like Japan, and therefore that what they did in Japan should be automatically applicable? Lack of imagination. Some people would consider this expression almost frustratingly neutral. Some people call it insensitivity, actually. Insensitivity of the Japanese to foreign culture, foreign values. And the clannishness of the Japanese obviously prevents Japanese from learning by observation what the social values and business practices are in the host countries. And so the end result is tragic on both sides. The Japanese are convinced that they are doing the right thing because they are doing what they do in any case.